You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. If you listen to my last show, I announced that the studio was going to be rewired, and as a result, the studio was shut down for all shows for 2 weeks. Fortunately, we have a separate editing room that is equipped for recording, and that's where I am today. I'm literally in a bunker on the Richland College campus broadcasting. So I'm going to have probably at least 8 shows before the studio is back online, and I'll be recording in this editing room. And it does have certain limitations. For example, I can't have my beginning and ending music. I'm going to have to really do that in post-production, which I will. And just for a point of information, I have changed the closing music. I always had some reservations of the closing music. And let me just spend a minute on that. It was for those that are interested in classical music, it was the ending of the 1812 Overture. And now, one of my reservations, it was just too loud, but it was also a Russian band, and it was live cannons and bells that gave it some reality, but it was just simply too loud, and it should be loud. If cannons are going off, and they were truly cannons going off, and the bells were ringing in the city where this was the whole symphony was given. This was just the ending. So I've eliminated that as my closing music. Really pick something that I think is more appropriate. And today, this show will be the first time I'll introduce that at the very, very end of the program, because I have a special project in mind, and I'll save that for a later date. It'll probably be at least a month or two before I have it ready. I'm going to do a video where my voice is speaking over the similar music, almost identical music, that I'll have at the ending today. But it's something that I really need to prepare. It will be a video, and I need to shoot video. It will be also an After Effects. So it's going to be a major project that I'll do, but I'll incorporate it into the show. And I probably won't give, I'll use today's closing music most of the time, but on special occasions, because this will be a little longer. See, my ending music, as well as my beginning music, is 30 seconds. It's a 30-second spot. And it's an excerpt from usually a much larger piece. And I intentionally do that because the show is the Pronk Pop Show is my commentary or opinions on breaking news stories or stories that are in the news typically that day or this week or will be in the news in the upcoming weeks. And I'm going to do that today, and I'm going to be covering the Veterans Affairs scandal, and I think it is a scandal. But before I do that, I wanted to at least alert you that we will be having at least 8 shows from, I'm going to call it the bunker, at Richland College. We won't be broadcasting Memorial Day. So we have 4 shows this week and 4 shows next week for a total 8, and that will get us to a total of 270 shows. My goal is to be at 400 shows by the end of the year and over 500 shows this time next year. And that is my goal. And hopefully in somewhere between now and the 500th show, I hope to have a national radio show, a syndication show. But initially it's to get to 500 to really polish the show, have more and more clips. And I'll be starting that this summer. And then in the fall, we're going to have a number of other changes. We're not only going to have more clips or what's called actuals, and it's shorts. It's usually a audio of some public figure talking about whatever the issue is, and it's typically 15 to 30 seconds. And in the past, I've done that, and it became somewhat of a pain, and now I'm going to get back to it. My goal is to have at least 2 audio clips per hour. That's a minimum, and ideally 4 audio clips an hour. So if I have a 1-hour show, at least have 2 to 4, maybe even five or six, depending on if they really are on point. Because and I need to say this, if you're new to listening to the show, the way you listen to the Prompt Pop Show is to go to pronkpops.wordpress.com. That's pronkpops, P-R-O-N-K-P-O-P-S .wordpress.com. And at the very top, you'll have links to at least the last 60 shows. And at the very bottom of that page, you'll have links to all my shows, as well as information about what the show is about. But in between those sets of links, you will have my notes or my show prep for today's show. And usually I'll have one or two stories per hour. Occasionally I'll have three or four. I think the most I've ever had is five or six when I do a two-hour show. What I'm ultimately shooting for is a two-hour show every day, because a two-hour show is 120 minutes. And that is very, very close to what a three-hour show is in commercial radio, because if you'll notice, especially if you're a first-time listener, we're just not equipped with a call-in system. We don't have enough listeners to justify that, because you want people calling in that are on point, that namely want to talk about what you're talking about, and you need a fairly large listener base, because typically only 1-2% of the people listening will actually call, and sometimes that's even high. So we're not equipped for that. You won't see any or hear any people calling in, nor do you have, we're commercial free because we're a college radio station, a web station. We don't broadcast over the airways. We broadcast over the internet. Most of my listeners, although they can listen to it while it's going over the air. This is not going over the air, because the studio, when I say over the air, over the internet right now, because I'm in a studio, an editing studio, but I'm really not broadcasting over the internet like I would be if I were in the studio, and that's the difference. All I'm doing right now is I'm recording the show, and then what I'll do is tomorrow morning I will edit it, And what I mean by edited, I don't take much out. I really try to, occasionally I'll have some dead spots, so I tighten it up and make sure to shorten it to get it at a length that's the minimum length. But usually what you're hearing is what I said, with some exceptions. I try to eliminate. So I've given you a little more inside baseball here, because this is really a transition period. We're going to really upgrade the studio in terms of the cabling and the quality. And I'm also upgrading the show and changing the music. And we'll have more and more audio clips to illustrate the stories. And I always wanted to do that, but there were some problems in terms of conversion of that. Now I found a better way to do that, that I can do it in a very timely manner. So it's really getting those clips together to do. It takes a little extra time, but it's well worth it. But you have to be very selective, and you got to really narrow it down. You can't play 3 or 4 minutes of someone else's material, because you do have certain limitations in terms of free use of someone else's material, and you got to really give credit. So if I'm taking, for example, an answer to a question on another show, whether it's Face the Nation or Fox News Sunday or whatever the show, and I really just want about 15 seconds of the answer, whoever was on the show, I can do that. I acknowledge who it is. And we're going to have more of that, because I can tell you what they said, but it gives more credibility if you actually hear it. And that's why I gave you my link to my companion blog, prompopops.wordpress.com, because today's show is a perfect example. It would be much better if I just played short clips, for example, of what the President of the United States has said, not only as president, but when he was running for president, and even before he was running for president, because it really has relevance today as to what is happening with the Veterans Affairs situation. Now, before I get into that, or maybe in conjunction with it, there's a question I think everyone should think about, and that in terms of how they would answer. What is the appropriate functions of a government? In this case, the federal government, but it applies equally to the state government. What are the appropriate functions of a government? Now, people are going to disagree or have different answers to that. If you've listened to any of my shows, you'll quickly understand, I'm what's called a classical liberal, sometimes referred to as a libertarian. But if you ask me what my political philosophy is, I will say I'm a classical liberal. And what I mean by that, I favor a representative republic where the government is limited in scope. Now, a couple of quick, important points. I'm not an anarch. An anarchist believes in no government. I believe in government, but limited government. And the question is how limited. Other people are for a much larger government, a much larger role for the government. But a question that you need to answer, because everyone is going to have their own political philosophy. What should be the legitimate role of a government? In our case, a federal government. Originally, the founding fathers set up what I favor, a constitutional republic. That's what we have. We don't have a democracy, although many people say America's democracy. The founders really were against democracy. They were for a limited constitutional government. So the Constitution spells out what the legitimate role of government is. Now, what do I consider the proper functions of government? First of all, to provide for the common defense. And what I mean by that, we live in an evil world. There are bad guys out there. And these bad guys, if they could, want to steal our stuff and kill our people. So the first, and I would say the prime, that's a better way to say it, the prime objective, the number one objective of any government is to provide for the defense of the nation and the people's property and their lives. So you need what today we call a Department of Defense. You need a military. Now, they were not in favor of standing armies. We have standing armies, navies, air force today. It's a little bit more complicated world that we live in. And there's always a danger of that. Fortunately, we've never had a situation where the military tried a coup, if you will, to take over the government, because the military believes in civilian control, and that's sort of ingrained. Now, I happen to be a veteran of the Air Force. I was in the Air Force for over 5 years. I volunteered, and most of that time, all of that time, was spent at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Area C, Air Force Systems Command, and I worked in, at that time, this was in the early 70s, mid-70s, at the F-15 Systems Program Office, or SPO. And I worked both in the contracts and in the financial budgetary areas. So, and that's somewhat unusual, because if you're in the military, you usually spend 2 to 3 years at one location, and you're transferred. You're moved around a lot. I was fortunate to spend 5 years in Dayton, Ohio, at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So I am a veteran. Now, I don't think you need to be a veteran to talk about the Veterans Administration, but I think it does give you a certain amount of insight. And I also happen to be a son of a professional soldier that was in the Army for 23 years and developed a disability, namely he had hepatitis more than once. So he was forced. He was going to be a 30-year man, but he was forced out of the military because of his disability. The first time they treated him well, and let me say this about care, and I can only really speak to my experience both growing up as a son of a professional soldier, and that's what my father preferred to be called. If you asked him, what are you? I am a professional soldier. And he was for 23 years. And both myself, my brother, my mother, as well as my father, had excellent health care when my father was on active duty and when I was on active duty. And that is one of the benefits if you serve in the military. Now, I'm not going to say that's true of everybody that's in the military. A lot of it is where you're at. Like I said, I was stationed in Dayton, Ohio, which is, at that time, they might have changed the name. That was the headquarters of Logistics Command, as well as the division, Aeronautical ASD, the Aeronautical Systems Division was there, and they were part of Systems Command. They're two different commands, but the headquarters of Logistics Command was at Wright-Patt, and when I was there, they had a B-52 bombers, Strategic Air Command, a bomber wing there. They were based there because I used to fly in the Aero Club. So I'm giving you a little background that I am a veteran, and I've had experience with the type of medical care you will get in the military, but I was at a command headquarters, and that's important, because if you're at a command headquarters, you would expect, and it was true, we had an outstanding hospital, outstanding dental care, and I was hardly ever sick, but I did injure myself playing tennis of all things and had to get some therapy. And I had the obvious dental problems and got treated. So I didn't really have much need, because I was young, much need for medical care. And that's typical of most young people. And knock on wood, I've had very little need for medical care, whether it's a doctor or surgery, anything. And I've been very, very fortunate. But there's a reason for that. It depends on what activities you engage in. And I like to ski, which is somewhat risky. And I did go skiing I think I took up skiing after I left the Air Force. But the point I'm trying to set the stage. Most people in the military on active duty, and I was on active duty, I think the general consensus is you get very good care, but it depends where you're based. Now, if you're out in the boonies, you're assigned to some small base, let's say, in a foreign country, you might not have as good care. Now, I will say, I was also what's called an Army brat. I was a son of someone in the Army, and we were stationed abroad. We were stationed both in Germany for 3 years, as well as Taipei, Taiwan. And in both instances, we had, again, I was growing up, I was a small child, but we had good care. Now, why I've been seldom sick or injured as an adult, I was what you would call a sickly child. I think I had all the childhood diseases and then some, including the pneumonia, measles, chicken pox, you name it, I had it. My mother would take me down, take me and my brother didn't have as much problem, but take me and my brother down to the local Army base. And sometimes that meant a commute. When we're in the United States, for example, we had to take a number of buses and trains to get to the Army base. I believe it was Fort Hamilton at the time. And that's something that you got to put up with. Yes, we had access to care, but it wasn't in a local neighborhood. Now, in a case of emergency, what my parents would have to do, and this was not covered, they would have to call a local doctor. And that on occasion happened, at least one or two, as memory serves, at least once or twice, that had to happen. Believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, at one time doctors would come to your house, would make house calls. Now, I'm really dating myself here, but I want to give you a sense of people care in the military, and it does change. What I've told you so far, I think, is the typical of experience of most people that have been in the military, whether it's the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, Marines. They usually get excellent health care when they're on active duty. And remember, when you're on active duty, it's 24/7. Does it mean you work 24/7? No, but you're on call 24/7. Fortunately for me, I had a very good military career. I enjoyed it. It was really developed a lot of skills, a lot of confidence, and I wouldn't pass it up. But I stayed at the same place in the United States for 5 years, which is not typical. Usually, you would be stationed at least two or three places. And before I got out, I had orders to go to Washington, D.C. That's probably more personal information than I've given on any show, but I'm giving it as background information. Now, what happens if you retire from the military? Obviously, I didn't retire. After 5 years, I resigned my commission and pursued other opportunities in the private sector. Most military personnel today either have a 20, 25, or 30-year career. And the military is very much, especially if you were an officer, which I was, it's up or out. So you need to get promoted. Now, usually and I was somewhat on a fast track, I could have made the military a career and probably would have gotten to at least the rank of colonel or above. But I decided that I had better opportunities, and I still think I made the right decision, because I wasn't rated. I wasn't a pilot. I went to many meetings, listened to many briefings, as well as on occasion brief general officers, But I would look around the room, and most of the key positions were filled by people that were rated. In other words, they were usually command pilots, because most of the directors, for example, at the F-15 program, were colonels, were full colonels, full birds. And their deputies typically were lieutenant colonels or GS-15s. Now, I had no desire to be a bureaucrat or work for the federal government, although I, on occasion, have applied for some of those positions, but that was rather rare. But I looked around the room on several occasions, and I noticed that invariably, the people that were the directors, and that's the equivalent of a colonel or a GS-15, but the colonels were rated. Now, remember, this was an Air Force organization, and it's the same with the Navy, the Marines, they're going to have certain experiences. And since this was the F-15 program, most of them were previously had service as fighter pilots. They were former pilots, but they were even more so former fighter pilots. Most of them were fighter pilots. Not all. We had some that were in transports, some that were in bombers. But most of the people, in terms of the officers that served in that organization, were rated pilots, usually with combat experience, and you could see it with the spaghetti or ribbons. So I decided, well, I'm never going to be a command pilot, and it's rather remote that I would be in a war situation, because I was slotted to be what's called initially, if I had stayed in, I would be a project manager and then a program manager. And that requires knowledge of a number of skill sets in terms of contracts, financing, engineering, configuration management, test. You had to be a jack of all trades, because ultimately I would initially manage a project and then a program if I had stayed in. And there are very, very few in the Air Force that really do that. But the one benefit of being in the Air Force and doing it is the Air Force is very much hands-on when we're talking new weapon systems. Now, I've probably given you more information about the military that you want to hear. So I want to get back to access to medical care. The conclusion I came to, and it's anecdotal information, but I think it's true of most people that have been in the military. The care, as far as I'm concerned, was excellent. It was available. And on the few occasions that I needed it, I had access to it. And it was primarily dental and then one injury that required a little therapy and some medication. I think I had an ear infection once. I took advantage of it. Even if I had to pay for it myself, it wouldn't have cost me that much, for the simple reason I was young. And that's the experience of most people. Most young people know that they're probably going to have a serious illness when they get much older, starting in their 50s, 60s, 70s, age starts to catch up, and then you're going to need more access to medical care. That's just the actuarial numbers. That's why many people, especially young people, are not big fans of Obamacare, for the simple reason, if they follow this, Obamacare, the whole purpose of Obamacare was to force, in other words, use government coercion to force young people to buy health insurance. And that and the premiums they pay are going to be largely used to pay the medical bills for people with pre-existing conditions. In other words, people that are sicker and older than them. In other words, it's a subsidy. It's a cross subsidy. It's an intergenerational subsidy, where young people who don't really have much need for medical care, what they are paying the insurance company or the government, depending on where they work, that money is really, in terms of the benefits that are paid out by the insurance company, let's keep it simple, are going to go to the older employees. Now, I've been in the private sector, and I used to sell group health insurance. So I know a little bit about this subject. And invariably, and I sold mostly to small business owners, typically 10 employees or less. I had some that were much larger, but typically they're the new small business owner, typically 10 employees or less. I sold a lot of small group health insurance. But invariably, who took advantage of the health insurance, in the sense that who were the users of that health insurance? They were the older employees, typically 40s, 50s, 60s, and wives. Because why? Usually young people become interested in health insurance when they get married and they want to have children. That's when you suddenly see young people get very interested in health insurance. And that's rational because they know that their wife or spouse is going to get pregnant and have a baby, and you run the risk of having serious complications. I have had clients that ran into that situation and had an excellent health insurance from an outstanding company, but they had some major medical bills. And we're talking hundreds of thousands because it was a premature baby. And that's why young people typically, while they're not very interested in having health insurance, they think they're invincible. That's the phrase you hear. You know, I'm never going to die. I'm never going to be injured. I really would rather spend the money on something else than health insurance. But once they get married, and it's usually the wife saying, honey, you know, I'm going to get pregnant, and you know I'm going to have a baby, and we run the risk of a large medical bills, we're going to have health insurance, and our children are going to have good health insurance. And usually they get that health insurance from their place of business, wherever they're being employed. And most businesses, that's the first benefit they provide. Now, one of the points I'm trying to make is, as you grow older, you take more, I say advantage of, you use doctors more. And that means you're going to have higher medical bills. Now, my view in terms of health insurance is you should buy catastrophic health insurance to really take care of those large medical bills, for example, those premature babies or serious illness, and have the highest deductible you can possibly stand. In other words, can you write a check for $5,000? Most people can't, especially if they're just starting out. That's why I'm a big advocate of having a health savings account where you save money or deduct it from your paycheck and put it in a savings account, a health savings account, an HSA, and that money can be used to pay your medical bills. So if you're not in the military, one of your concerns when you're hired is, do you have health insurance? Now, for many years, I worked for some large companies, and I knew that. That was one of their selling points. We provide excellent, comprehensive medical care, and I really didn't worry about it. For many, many years, my time in the Air Force and the time I was in the private sector, mainly in the aerospace defense industry, I didn't really think much of health insurance because it was always provided. I didn't shop it. My employer did that for me. And luck of the draw, I usually had excellent coverage. But I didn't really take advantage of it. Now, really, the only two areas that I really need coverage for was dental as well as for my eyesight. And usually the dental was covered, but the eyesight wasn't or was limited. Now, the best coverage will have comprehensive health insurance with low deductibles. And I mean by low, $500, $250, as well as a copay, usually 80-20, where you pay 20 up to a limit, typically of $5,000. That's more or less what I had in the private sector. And I usually had a dental plan, and in some cases, I also had a vision plan. That's good coverage. And many people deliberately work for large companies, or they work for the government, and the government provides them insurance. Now, what happened over time, especially when I left the aerospace industry and really had my own firm, I had to provide my own insurance. And I was also marketing or selling group insurance to small businesses. And I quickly discovered one of the key things small businesses want to do is provide first themselves, because they're working for the company, and they want to provide coverage for their wife and the children, and they want to cover their employees. Because if they want to attract and retain good employees, employees are going to be asking about that. They're competing against other businesses, and that's very, very important. There's competition for labor. You have to be competitive, not only in terms of the salaries you provide your employees, but also in terms of the employee benefits, whether it's health care, which is usually the first benefit provided. Usually next will be some life insurance, usually together with that. They might provide disability coverage, and then they have a retirement plan. That is the more typical order of the type of benefits companies provide. Now, if you work for for a while I worked for Fortune 500 companies, they provided all that. But when you go to a small company, especially one that's starting out, and most of my clients were small companies, most of them had been established for a couple of years. Occasionally I would have a startup and I would approach them and they say, call me in a year. And I would call them in a year and they might say, okay, we can afford it now, or call me in another year. So you got to keep in touch. But affordability is key. It doesn't matter whether you're a small or a large company. If you're a large company, you have thousands of employees, you're going to shop and you're going to put a fine point to it. And you're going to have people that specialize in just this area because you have a large human resources department. Now, people are free to choose what career they want. They have a choice as to what companies they want to work for. I had a choice of I could have stayed in the military very easily and probably had an excellent career for 20 years, retire as a colonel. I decided to get out. And believe it or not, most people in the military decide to get out. The overall majority get out. I was offered a regular commission and accepted it. That's why I served 5 years. Initially, I had a commitment of 4 years, but in the second year, I was offered a regular commission. I accepted it, and I had some reservations, but I was told basically to accept it. You know, if you change your mind, you change your mind, and I did change my mind, and I don't regret that. But I could have stayed in and not worried at all, while I was in the military. And many people make a career in the military, or they serve in the federal government, and it's also provided for them. If you work for the federal government, you really don't have much choice. Let me back up. You do have choice because in most cases, they'll give you money and you decide which insurance plan you want. Let me say that again. In most, I won't say all, but most, you're given a certain amount of money and then you shop and pick which insurance plan fits your needs. And that is the way it should be. I'm a big advocate of free markets and competition. And that means you shop and see what's available. You're in the best position to decide what plan makes most sense for you. And that's what federal employees have. Now, if you're in the private sector, and this is a problem, not a big problem, but somewhat of a problem, most people get their insurance, health insurance, through their employer. And the employer will ask around what people want, but the employer decides which group health insurance you will have. In my experience, again, it's been generally favorable. Most businesses offer it. Not everyone. I've worked for some people that simply couldn't afford it or wouldn't pay for it, but most of them simply couldn't afford it. It's not that they didn't want it. They just weren't profitable enough yet to provide it, but it was rather high on their agenda. Because I would talk to the owners about it. And I would say 85 to 95% of the employees were completely satisfied with the health insurance that their employer provided. Now, most employers would pay for 100% for the employee. Sometimes they would require a contribution maybe of 20%, but most would pay for the employee. Some would also pay for the spouse and dependents, but others would really split it 50-50. If you needed coverage for your wife and child, the employer would pay half, you would pay half. Again, it depends. It depends on the situation. It's really a case by case. And you have the freedom to choose who you want to work for. So if health benefits are an important priority, I would say work for a large company because they will provide it. But even small, medium-sized will provide it. But then the question is, how much do you have to pay? And that can become an issue. And who's deciding here? The employer's deciding. I would much rather have a system where the employer says, listen, I will give you so many dollars, and you buy whatever insurance you want. In other words, that's part of the total compensation package. I think that's a much better system where the individual has responsibility of buying, or has the option, if you will, of buying individual coverage, just like, you know, I've yet to have an employer that provides me auto insurance or homeowner's insurance or renter's insurance or disability group, but not individual. In other words, That's your responsibility. Take the money you earn, and if that's important to you, spend the money on that. You're free to choose how you spend your money, and you're in the best position to determine what you need. What do you need? Now, I need to bring this back, because I'm not going to go, I'm leading up to something. If you're a veteran, if you become disabled, like my father, he was typically treated they retired to Florida and was treated, he would go to a Navy base, even though he's Army. But remember, he retired from the military, and he would have to get an appointment, and it was a drive. It wasn't local. Initially it was, and then they moved, but it wasn't in the neighborhood. I guess that's the point. It was a drive. And that's the typical situation. It depends where you retire. Now, many military will retire near a military base, either an Army, a Navy, or Air Force base, and their records are sent to them, but they are not first priority. The first priority of the military are the people on active duty, and that's the way it should be. So they have to call and get an appointment. They didn't use... I'm going to continue this the next show. I've been basically told I got to wrap it up. But I want to at least give you a lead in to where I'm going with this. The problem we have now is we have a lot of veterans from the Iraqi-Afghanistan wars as well as other wars. Many of them are getting older and older. Some are well off that they'll never go to the Veterans Administration. Or if they were a regular Army, Air Force, Navy, they'll go to the nearest Army base. Typically, they won't go to the Veterans Administration. But some need the Veterans Administration because they really can't afford it. And the scandal today that's developing is the fact that they're put on waiting list. And where I'm going with this, and I'll pick it up on the next show, is the Veterans Administration is a excellent example of what single payer is, where the single payer is the federal government. The Veterans Administration runs many hospitals, over, I think, about 187 hospitals and several hundred clinics across the United States. And the problem is the sheer number of veterans, there's a waiting list. And the problem is if you have an emergency, you need to be treated now. And we're getting a lot of scandals in the news from various hospitals. And this is a developing story. But this is a perfect example of what single payer is about. They really don't have a choice in the sense that they don't have the wherewithal. Either they don't have insurance or they don't have the money to pay for medical care. So their last resort is the Veterans Administration. And because they were a veteran, typically because they were disabled, they have access to the Veterans Administration. But the problem is the quality of care and the timeliness of care. And I think there's a better way. And that's what I'll explore in the next show. You have been listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas, with the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. Thank you for listening, and part two of this show will be tomorrow. Thank you. Have a great day. Bye-bye.